Hey there, welcome to Leadership Portraits Podcast. Today I have with me Chris Yaden from Sapria, and I'll let him share with you a little bit about who he is and what he does. But I'm really excited about having Chris with here to here with us today. He is going to share a little bit about Sapria is a nonprofit. So he's got some really great insights into how nonprofits work and how leadership works in nonprofits. He also has some experience in the for-profit world as well. So I think it's a really interesting conversation to have about the difference between those two worlds. And then he's got some other interesting insights to share as well. So I'm really excited for the conversation with Chris today. So welcome, Chris.
Thanks. It's great to be here, and I appreciate you having me on.
Well, I appreciate you being able to join us. I'm excited for the conversation. So tell us a little bit about who you are and please tell us a little bit about Sapria as well.
Sure. Yeah, I think the best way for me to kind of connect those two worlds is to briefly go back to my childhood. So as a young boy, I grew up in what to me was a very idealistic setting. I was growing up right on the edge of a fruit farm. So a little bit rural, not super rural. We had everything we needed around us or wanted, but had that rural experience of being right next to a fruit farm. I spent more of my summer days in bare feet than with shoes on, roaming around the orchard, getting into things I probably shouldn't have, and certainly wouldn't let my kids get into today, right? And it was pretty carefree. I got to do what I want when I wanted, and got to explore and just be a kid. And that idealistic view of my childhood continued for a long time, but it started breaking down, particularly in my young adult years, as I became aware of family members of mine who had experienced various types of abuse, including child sexual abuse. So while for me, I kind of lived this idealistic childhood and came out, quote unquote, unscathed, that wasn't true of the people closest to me and people I loved dearly. And so I remember as a young adult and even into my later adult years, kind of having that bubble popped, that idealistic bubble got popped. And I remember feeling really, really angry and kind of having those emotions of that it is not okay that this abuse happened. It's not okay that society looked the other way. It's not okay that the abuse was hidden. It's not okay that my family members have had to suffer the long-lasting results of the abuse. So to kind of connect that to today and who I am today, I'm the managing director of an organization by the name of Sapria. And at Sapria, we exist to liberate both individuals and society from child sexual abuse and its lasting impacts. So, bottling up, or maybe better said, leveraging some of that frustration, I've turned it into passion for this cause to both reduce the amount of abuse that happens in our society, as well as to help those that have experienced abuse to find healing from those lasting impacts. And that's my day-to-day work at Sapria, and I love what I get to do.
That's a great story, and I relate to that story a lot because I also grew up in farm country and with all the freedom that provides, but also with almost the sheltering that you get. You don't realize some of the things that are going on. And when I myself started hearing some of the numbers, as an adult of things and started seeing the effects. It's amazing when you start to realize that just the sheer number of people who have experienced some level of abuse like that.
Yeah, and child sexual abuse specifically, I'll share a few of those numbers really quick. So the numbers will vary based on how researchers define sexual abuse. And they vary from about 1 in 4 children to about 1 in 10 children. So that's kind of your range. So, on that higher end, 1 in 10 children will be sexually abused by age 18. That's usually defining abuse by abuse, including some sort of touch. But in our day and age, there's a lot of sexual abuse that happens where touch isn't involved. And it can be just as impactful in a negative way and have just as much lasting damage as when touch is involved. So when you include the type of sexual abuse that is done digitally, things like sextortion, as an example, the number's much, much higher. So it's 1 in 5 children will be sexually abused by age 18. And that's not a cherry-picked stat. It's not a single research study that comes from. There are hundreds, maybe even into the thousands at this point, of research studies that have validated and revalidated these incident rates. And that's really hard to swallow when you think about 5 children, or 5 minors, one of those 5 statistically has experienced child sexual abuse.
It's incredible. It is incredible to think in those terms. So tell us a little bit about Sapria and what you're doing for to help those statistics.
Yeah. So at Sapria, we have 3 major pillars. The first pillar is healing, and we focus on helping adult women who were sexually abused as children heal from that abuse. And what we're doing there is basically bolstering and putting support around the individual therapeutic experience. So we do all the things that individual therapy doesn't, that are necessary or helpful to help an adult female survivor of child sexual abuse heal. And if we want, we can get into more detail of the specifics, but that's the general idea. The second major pillar that we focus on is empowering parents and other primary caregivers to both reduce the risk that their child will be abused, so we have less of those 1 in 5, but also reduce the risk that their child will abuse another. One thing people don't often realize about the issue of child sexual abuse is approximately half of the incidents are a minor on another minor, with the 2 most common being, think of a 14, 15-year-old abusing a 7, 8, 9-year-old, or teen-on-teen sexual assault. And whether it comes from an adult or comes from an older minor, both are exploiting that position of trust, or even in a teen-on-teen sexual assault case, exploiting power for their advantage, and it has the same traumatic effect, or can have the same traumatic effect on child. So we not only want to reduce the risk our children will be abused, we also want to reduce the risk that our children will abuse others. And then the last pillar is really leading out in some public leadership to help move the needle from a societal change perspective. This is one issue our society has largely ignored. We've chosen to look the other way. It's part of that frustration I felt in that story I shared at the beginning. We've dealt with a lot of issues in our society. We're dealing with a lot of issues, but this one we've largely ignored. We've said, I don't want to deal with that one. That's what we've said as society. And we're trying to change that, change those norms and how the average American views the issue and how they engage with the issue. So that's more those macro levers that we're trying to pull to bring about societal change. So those are the 3 big pillars that we focus on at Sapria. There's lots of detail underneath those pillars, but those are the 3 biggies.
And this is such important work because once we can figure out how to solve this, we can create such incredible change in society and in individuals. Having had a chance to kind of hear some of the stories, this it it creates, it manifests a lot of different ways in individuals. Some people, I've heard some of the stories of some people become very like hyper successful. Some people, you know, are on the other end of spectrum. You know, they struggle becoming successful in their lives, and you know, whatever success means to them. So, you know, addressing this can create such impact across the board. And you know, it's leadership becomes such a key piece of this. So talk a little bit about how you see leadership really playing a part in driving this societal change.
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about the societal change, but I want to build it up a little bit with something you just referenced, and that is the power that can be unleashed if we actually solve this problem. I think that's a really good, and I'm glad you brought it up, a really good kind of base that helps us understand why that public leadership is so critical. So when someone is burdened with post-traumatic stress symptoms, it really has a negative impact on their ability to contribute to their communities, whether that be their immediate family system, their workplace, their broader community, or our nation or the world in its entirety. When they learn how to manage through that trauma successfully, that potential gets released, and it's like this powerful wave that happens. We often refer to it as post-traumatic growth. So liberating, that's why we use that term liberating. When we help liberate individuals from child sexual abuse, individually, they create a ton of impact themselves. When we talk about liberating society, it's the cumulative effect of liberating not only survivors, but liberating society from the burden of the continual cycle of bringing new abuse into our world. Because that new abuse not only burdens the individual, but also burdens the family, the immediate communities, the broader community. So it really does unleash a ton of potential. And one thing we know about our country specifically is when we finally choose to solve a problem, we're really good at it. I'm not saying we solve it overnight, but once we choose, we are really good at it. The problem is helping us make the choice. So that's where that public leadership comes in, and what's often referred to as societal change theory. And this is an area of personal work for me. I don't know that I would call myself a full-on expert yet, but I've developed a lot of expertise in societal change theory. How do you move broad societal norms, which is very different than how do you help an individual change? How do you help society change? Are different levers that you pull than how you help an individual change. So at the highest level, that public leadership around societal change, like many things, you have to ask what do we have to do, who has to be involved, and how do we do it? And I've relied on tremendous experts from the academic world and some from the consulting world to really help me form my opinion on how this question gets answered. And these experts have studied it extensively. And so at Sapria, we do a lot of work to pull these macro levers. I'm going to just give you a couple of quick examples of what I'm talking about to connect the dots. So one of those macro levers we have to pull is issue awareness. So we know from research that only about 30% of Americans believe child sexual abuse is a solvable problem. So think about that. Nearly 70% of Americans don't even think the problem can be solved. So if that's our belief, if that is our current mindset as a society, even if we think it's a horrific problem, why are we going to invest time and energy to addressing the problem if we don't even believe it's solvable? So that is a mental construct, a societal norm that has to change
Right.
if we're going to solve that problem. So issue awareness is the what, meaning the solution to address that particular issue. So we've got to move that needle to where instead of 30% of Americans believe it's solvable, how about 50%? How about 70%? And eventually 100%. In order to do that, we have to help the public through issue awareness understand the issue, understand their power to impact the issue, how they can leverage that power to impact the issue for good, and make it easy for them. We do that through issue awareness campaigns. So that's kind of one of those key societal change principles. We've seen this in past movements. So if we look at something like, I'll take one that I lived through. When I was a kid, I was not in a seatbelt. I was certainly not in a car seat. And when I was driving down the road, I might have even been hanging out the window. By the time I was a parent, there was no way in the world my child was going home from the hospital in anything but a car seat.
Right.
How did that shift happen? That's societal change. And in that case, there were several levers that were pulled. But going back to our example, one of those big levers that was pulled was issue awareness. There were a ton of awareness campaigns that hit us as a society between the time when I was a little child and by the time I was a parent that said, you need to buckle up your children. And they came in various flavors, various forms, various campaigns, but there was a ton of work done in it. That's a real life past example of this particular principle. The actors, there's nine actors involved in societal change. A few examples would be nonprofits, corporations, public administrators, policymakers, there's faith leaders, there's many others. Those actors got involved and started caring about the issue and influenced the public. So you have to engage the actors if you're going to engage societal
right,
change.
Right.
And then the last thing, which is kind of the how, there are certain techniques that are used to influence people. And specifically, I draw on the teachings from Crucial Influence by Joseph Grenny and some of his colleagues that talks about six sources of influence based on motivation and ability. And that motivation and ability at the personal level, at the peer level, and at the structural level. So there's different levels. So like structural motivation, you have to put policies in place to help structurally motivate society to shift. You have to do personal motivation. Anyway, I won't go into all the details because it can get pretty complex pretty quick, but at least it gives you a sense of what I mean when I say you pull these macro levers. Societal change theory is about pulling these macro levers, doing them systematically in order to help society shift their norms and how they see an issue and how they address an issue.
How much of that is impacted by the fact that this is a heavy topic? It's an uncomfortable topic. People don't necessarily always come forward when these things happen. How much is impacted by that? And how can we start to shift that so that when something happens to someone, they know that they have a support system and they know that it doesn't have to be an uncomfortable thing to talk about, and that we can open up and we can get the support that we need to the people who need it.
Yeah. It starts with what you just did, and that is acknowledge where we're at. The next thing I would call out, once we acknowledge that, hey, there's a lot of shame and a lot of stigma for survivors, and it's really hard for them to speak. And that shame and stigma is not because of the issue itself. It's because of how society has framed the issue.
Right.
Does that make sense? That's what I'm saying. And so we can change how society has framed the issue. And we have on multiple topics. So Let's take breast cancer as an example. 30 years ago, breast cancer would have been spoken about in hushed terms, whispered, would have been whispered, right? If it was talked about at all. Today, not only is it spoken about, but on multiple times a year, you can find a ton of breast cancer survivors proudly running down a street declaring that they are survivors. That's an example of how society's frame the issue got shifted. We can see other similar examples. Let's take the issue of mental health, because we're in the middle of that shift right now. It's not done, but our openness of talking about our mental health today compared to 5 years ago, compared to 10 years ago, compared to 30 years ago is drastically different. And we still have room to grow on that one. We're seeing the same thing happen with suicide, which is an aspect of mental health and the willingness to talk about suicide. So it's not that the topic's hard. That's not the problem. The problem is how society has chosen to approach the topic that's the problem. So those are the norms we have to adjust and change, so that survivors can more comfortably raise their hand and say, I'm a survivor and I want help. Parents can more comfortably raise their hand and say, I want to learn how to prevent this with my children. And that's part of that societal change work as well, when we talk about changing those societal norms or constructs. One of the best techniques, and I'll kind of finish this thought with this, as we look at historical movements, one of the very best techniques, and it's going to sound a little counterintuitive, but one of the very best techniques to change societal norms is actually to help courageous, brave survivors tell their stories. Because what that does is it creates proximity, which breaks down the barriers. So, the first person in my life that told me their breast cancer survivor story, a woman to a man, it was probably pretty uncomfortable for them. But when that proximity was created of someone I knew, someone I loved, someone I cared about, shared their story with me and let me hold that, my individual construct around whether it was okay or not okay to talk about cancer, and specifically breast cancer, my construct changed. Now, multiply that over thousands of conversations and then millions of conversations, and we see how society changes these constructs. So, having survivors share their stories to create proximity. Because every American has someone close to them that's a survivor of child sexual abuse. So if we create that proximity, we will quickly and effectively break down these barriers that create the stigma and the shame associated with being a survivor of child sexual abuse that drives them into secrecy.
So really, I mean, if we talk about someone like me who's not necessarily doing the kind of work that you're doing or in that kind of leadership position in that. So if you look at just someone like me or someone in the audience, it's just starting to create that comfort for people so that they can talk to it. They can start by talking to me about it or a friend or whoever. Then we can start to expand that out and become more comfortable across the board.
Yeah, and let me explain exactly how that happened. So I would be very surprised if in the next year you didn't have someone say, "Hey, Jennifer, I heard you address child sexual abuse on your podcast. I wanted to share something with you." And then they share their story. When we start advocating around the issue, whether it's having someone on a podcast, whether it's, hey, saying, hey, I heard about this great nonprofit that addresses child sexual abuse, and I want to tell you about it. When we start talking about the topic, whether we're a survivor or not, it creates a space where survivors are more likely to feel safe with us
right.
in sharing their story. We have to be prepared to hold that, right? They can be hard stories. They can be difficult to hear. And we don't have to solve it. We don't have to take on the trauma. But we need to be a place where they can safely share their story and they can find empathy from us, or at least safety from us.
Right.
If we can be that, it breaks down those barriers. That's how normal, everyday people can be a part of the solution.
That's so powerful. And I think if we can all start to realize that we have that power to be that support system for others, then it really does start to create that change.
No question. And being a support system, I'll emphasize again, I said it just a moment ago, doesn't mean you have to solve the problem.
Right.
There are professional organizations, there are individual therapists, there are online resources to help the survivor address their trauma.
Right.
But we need to make it okay for them to share that they're a survivor. That's our job as the public.
Right.
To break down these stigmas, to break down these societal norms that constantly yell at the survivor and say, it's not okay for you to share. This is too ugly. It's too gross. It's too this. It's too that. It's too whatever they want to say, or whatever goes on in their mind, that narrative that's being told over and over again in their mind. It's too this, too that, too anything. We're the ones that can help counter that internal narrative that's going on. And frankly, that internal narrative has been partially formed by how society has right. made it a taboo topic. So we've caused the problem, we can solve the problem.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the things that I appreciate about what you're doing with Sapria, what Sapria is doing is now for myself, when that person does come to me, I have a resource that I can say, you know, have you heard about this organization? And so now I have a resource that I can at least refer someone to and say, go check them out, go see what they can. So it doesn't fall on me to, like you were saying, I don't have to solve the problem. Yeah. I can help by making a recommendation.
And the great thing about making that recommendation, our resources, is due to generosity of our donors, all our resources are free. So that's an easy recommendation. It's not like, hey, you need to go buy something from Sapria. Right. They have, and not only are they free, but we meet the individual where they're at. We have online resources they can consume from the comfort of home. If they don't want to go out and do something, they just want to deal with it themselves right. from their couch, we've got that. If they want to get engaged in a community, we have support groups. Mm-hmm. If they want to go through a more involved program, we have our retreat or our healing webinar. So we'll meet the survivor where they're at in their journey, wherever that is.
Right.
So that referral becomes easier because we have a viable solution for them based on where they're at in their journey, and it's free.
Yeah. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So tell me a little bit about, though, from a leadership perspective, because that, you know, that's one of the topics that we like to talk about here. What have you learned from a leadership perspective working with this kind of an organization that you maybe didn't understand before you started doing this kind of work?
Yeah. So just a really brief background in my career. I'm almost 30 years into my career. Two-thirds of that was spent in for-profit, and the last 10 years has been spent in nonprofit. The first thing I learned, and this is not the answer to your question, is that working in nonprofit, at least if you're going to do it right, is actually more similar to for-profit than people think. If you're going to do it right.
Right.
There are a lot of poorly run nonprofits because they do not use the disciplines that are used or demanded by for-profit entities. That's a problem in our sector, and that has to change. And frankly, is changing. It's changing rapidly right now. Nonprofits really maturing in that realm. So I don't want to paint the wrong picture that all nonprofits are poorly run. That's not the case. But historically, it's been a big challenge, and we're in a shift right now. So that one's a little counterintuitive because it's like, wow, they're the same. Now, what's different? There are differences. There are certainly differences. There's a few from a leadership that I'll call out. One of the, I'd say, most difficult or hardest parts of my leadership journey in coming to nonprofit is the people that the employees that work in nonprofit engage very differently with the organization and have different motivations than the employees I worked with or staff or team members in a for-profit. And of course, there's crossover, but one of my favorite pieces of research is some research in organizational behavior that focuses on zookeepers. And really briefly, here's what the researchers looked at. Zookeepers have one of the highest risk jobs. It's a very dangerous job. It's very unglamorous. They don't get paid well, but they have one of the highest retention rates. So the organizational behavior research into zookeepers is like, why do they stick with this job when it's dangerous, their pay stinks, and the job is pretty gross in many ways? Why do they stick with it? And it's because they're motivated differently. And what organizational behavior and leadership has learned from this research is those that engage in the nonprofit sector and other human services, so think healthcare, education, those to some degree government, the reasons that people work in those industries, what they're motivated by, is very different than those that choose to work in the for-profit world. So I've had to really change my leadership to adjust to that workforce. And we can get into details or as much details as you want, but at the highest level, that's been one of the biggest differences I've seen from a leadership perspective, moving from for-profit to nonprofit.
That's fascinating. So my education background was in teaching. So I went to school to become a teacher. And I can remember going through those classes. And one of the big messages that we got was, it's okay that you're not going to be making a lot of money. That's not what you're here for, that you're here to make a difference. And so that was something that became, now I ended up in I ended up in corporate. And so then I had to adjust kind of the other way, from that whole mindset to the more corporate mindset. And it's fascinating though, when you think about what motivates us to do what we do and how leadership. A friend of mine talks a lot about situational leadership, like adjusting your leadership skills for the situation and the individual. And I'm sure that probably plays a big part in how you become a leader as well.
Yeah, let me give you a kind of an analogy or an example of this difference and how you have to adjust to this situational leadership. So if we go back to the zookeeper example, let's say we're towards the end of a fiscal year and the zoo has $10,000 extra in their budget. And the zookeeper over the elephants has been advocating all year for improving the elephants' feed. And that zookeeper becomes aware of this $10,000. And the management at the zoo is struggling. Should we use this $10,000 to do an extra fundraiser so we can earn $30,000 of extra revenue? Or should we improve the elephant's feed? And if that decision happens at the management level without heavy, heavy involvement from that elephant zookeeper, it's very predictable what's going to happen. The elephant zookeeper is going to immediately go to, they don't care about the animals. They should have bought better elephant feed. What they did was unethical and immoral. That's how that zookeeper is going to perceive the issue. So when we talk about the nonprofit sector and situational leadership, one big leadership change I had to make is when choosing between two goods in for profit, we can make a decision and go, and the staff would be like, they could see in their mind, they could see, yeah, they were both fine choices. I preferred choice A and they chose choice B. That's not the end of the world. Let's get behind it and go. It's not a moral issue to them. It's not attached to their identity as a worker. It's just a decision. But in the nonprofit sector, the workers attach decisions a lot more to their identity, their core identity as a human being.
Right.
And things become when it's part of your core identity, you start looking at decisions more through a moral lens as opposed to just choosing between two options. So that zookeeper over the elephant saw that as immoral. Management was like, hey, these are both good choices. I can choose A or B. They both will benefit the zoo. They chose B, and the elephant zookeeper thought they should have chosen A. And instead of just going, oh, they were both good choices and that's fine, they're like, the fact that the management didn't choose A, they've made an immoral decision. They don't care about the elephant, right? So you have to spend a lot more time, I found in my leadership, in working with nonprofit staff to understand decisions, to participate in decisions, to have those discussions about morality and what is moral and ethical as it relates to decisions in order to help direct your organization in decision making. And frankly, it slows things down.
Yeah, I could see. That's it takes a lot of interesting different skills too. So what would you say are some of the leadership skills that you either use the most or you think that those who may be pursuing something in a more of a nonprofit might need to think about building as they're doing that.
Yeah, I mean, your question reminds me of there's a book called Multipliers. And in that book, it talks about, and I'm not going to get the terms right from the book, so someone that really knows the book well will know what I'm talking about, but the concept is what's important. There's a concept that where we as leaders can inadvertently diminish other people. Meaning we're not doing it purposefully, but how we operate or how we lead actually diminishes those that we're trying to lead. And one of the ways that we do that sometimes as leaders is by getting to answers too quickly from the leadership perspective and not allowing the team to go through the struggle of coming to the same or a similar answer, or even a different answer for that matter. And this goes back to what I brought up a little bit by about speed and slowing things down. When we go from a Oh, that's interesting. What's
I know, I don't know what happened there. That's weird. Hang on. Yeah.
It's like she doesn't like my answer there. Anyway, so we can accidentally diminish by taking our broad-based organizational knowledge and coming up with solutions too quickly without properly socializing those decisions and including feedback from team members as a critical exercise, not just in buy-in, which is what we usually think about when we think about feedback, but the helping them struggle through the decision themselves. And helping them go through that learning exercise. So anyway, that's what comes to mind when I think about the question you asked.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There's so much in human behavior that you have to understand. I think across the board from a leadership perspective, and I think that's one of the reasons that I know quite a few people who've gotten into leadership who had like minors in psychology, and I think just kind of understanding that human behavior is critical in leading these groups, whether it's for profit, nonprofit, whatever, or even, community groups or any kind of leadership you're taking on.
Well, and leadership has changed over time in corporate America, including nonprofit America, from the authoritarian leadership of yesteryear to the leadership of today, which is if you can't lead through influence today, you're going to fail as a leader. You have it's not about my way or the highway. It's not about this is where we're going. Get behind me and follow me. You have to be able to influence those around you. And again, I would go back to a book I referenced earlier called Crucial Influence. It's one of my favorites on the topic of leadership influence because it gives you good systematic ways to influence other humans as a leader.
So on that topic, how do you, over the years, and you said you're about 30 years into your career, over the years as you have come up as a leader, what have you found to be your resources? You've mentioned a couple of books. But what is the best way you found to learn? Is it through books? Is it through, podcasts are becoming big things, videos? I mean, what have you found the best ways to learn? And do you have any great recommendations?
So in terms of ways to learn and those few examples you gave, I'd say yes, yes, and yes. I've had a really interesting formal education experience. I'll share it with you and I'll talk about the benefits of it. So I early in my career, regular college age, your typical young adult college ages, I went through my junior year and then I stopped. My career was taken off and I stopped. I didn't go back and finish my undergraduate degree until my 30s.
Oh, interesting.
And I actually am finishing, in fact, in just a couple of weeks, a master's degree. So
Oh, congratulations.
thank you. My formal education journey has occurred at various stages in my life. And though I don't recommend it, I'm not telling people to not get it done early, but I can tell you there has been a huge advantage of that formal education being combined with me having experience. My ability to process a theory or a study that a professor brings up in context of real-world experience has significantly increased my ability to retain information and apply it. So even when I look at formal education, the principle of continuous learning and always learning has existed in my life. Outside of that, I've done executive education. I loved some work I did at the Kellogg School at Northwestern. So, more of that executive education piece has been part of my career. Working with consultants, I've read a lot of books on leadership and on various topics. You know, there are smart people in our world, and they want to share their information with us. And lots of books, lots of podcasts, you know, as those have become more relevant, seminars, conferences. You know, you can go on and on. Even just spending time in our friend Google, or the search engine or AI engine of your choice. There is so many ways to get at information. I think the most important principle for me has been willing to be humble enough to seek learning. And what it is, what the channel is, will change over time, but the principle of continuous learning is what's core.
I love the fact that the resources that we now have available to us are endless. With the Coursera and the master class and certification programs and distance learning. I mean, there's so many options now for learning. Absolutely formal education is valuable. But there's so many other options as well. And I'm like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I'm always looking for, new things. But I love the fact that we have so many resources available to us now to do that in whatever form we want. If we want to go to a class, or if we want to do it at home, or however we want to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I really appreciate your time. I know your time is very valuable, so I appreciate you giving us your time and sharing this information. We could probably spend another 3 hours talking about this stuff, but before we wrap up, though, I do want you to share with us with Sapria, with the work you're doing, Sapria, how can others become involved? What are the ways that we can help, whether it's donations or volunteering, or what are the different ways that you're looking to help with Sapria, or to become involved, or just to become aware and know more about it?
I'm going to just hit a quick list on several items.
Okay.
If you're a survivor, go to sapria.org. No matter where you're at in your survivor journey, early, late, somewhere in the middle, go see what resources we have to offer you and take advantage of them. You're worth it. You can heal. There's people that love you and care about enough about you to provide you the resources to heal. Take advantage of it. If you're a parent or primary caregiver, you can get ahead of this problem for your children. Go to our website, sapria.org, under prevention. There's great resources for community education and individual micro-learning segments you can do on your own. Go consume that information, learn what it means to engage in parenting behaviors that reduce risk. If you want to support the work of Sapria, we need your help desperately. The way we can make these resources free is because of people like you that are willing to give. And that giving can vary a lot. It can be, you know, you can give a dollar a month, go on our website and donate a dollar a month. You have the ability to give millions, go to our website, reach out to me. We'll figure out how to get that done. You're somewhere in between, go to our website and find a way to give. Specifically, we have a great event coming up, and if it's possible, maybe you can put the link in the show notes. But we have our international gala coming up on June 8th. It will be held in Georgia, in Atlanta specifically, at the Georgia Aquarium, and it will be a great venue. We expect people obviously from Georgia coming, but also people will travel in for our gala, and we welcome you to come participate in that gala. And the link in the show notes will link you to either be a sponsor or to purchase tickets, purchase a table and bring some of your friends, whatever fits for you. We'd love to have you come celebrate with us and give back. Anyway, those are some of the ways I would recommend that people get involved.
Thank you. And yes, all of those links will be in the show notes. And I'll be there at the gala, so I'm looking forward to participating in that and seeing everyone there. So would love to have anyone join us as well. So any parting advice for leaders out there that you would love for people to know?
As someone 30 years in my career, with 27 of those years being in leadership and managing and leading other human beings, my biggest piece of advice I would give is be a continuous learner, be willing to adjust to the needs and wants of those that you're leading, and learn through that continuous learning how to influence as opposed to leveraging your authority in order to help people move the direction that's best for them, best for society, best for the organization or environment that you're leading.
That's great advice. I love it. I love it. Well, thank you so much for joining us. What great insights. Again, if you want to participate and help with Sapria in any way, please check out those links. I appreciate it, Chris. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been great to be with you.
All right. Well, this has been Leadership Portraits, and I look forward to seeing you next time.